Today is August 17th, 1973. The following interview is with Joseph J. Adams, A.D.A.M.S., a staff assistant in the Office of the Counsel to the President. The interview will take place in Mr. Adams' office in the old Executive Office Building. The interviewer is Terry Good.
Okay, and I'll start off and ask very basic questions to put everything in perspective. When did you join the White House staff?
I started on, I believe it was February 12th of this year.
And your last day on the staff?
Is today, which is August 17th. So it's slightly over 6 months that I've been here.
The period of time that you were on the staff, what was your title?
I was staff assistant within the Office of the Counsel to the President.
So for that entire time you were here in the Office of the Counsel?
Yes, I was.
Where could we reach you 5 or 10 years from now, or whenever, by mail?
Okay, well, immediately subsequent to this, as a matter of fact, this coming Monday, I'll be working as special assistant to the General Counsel in the Department of the Treasury. In regard to contact, I guess it would be best to give my parents' home address in New York, and that's 212 Burns, B-U-R-N-S Street, Forest Hills, New York. The zip is 11375. F-O-R-E-S-T. H-I-L-L-S.
And you're a member of several bar associations.
Right. I attended and graduated from Stanford Law School in California and was admitted to the state bar out there. And then, having passed my bar examination, came back to Washington and worked as a trial attorney with the Civil Aeronautics Board. Did that for about a year and a half. And then went to work as an assistant to the General Counsel of the Committee for the Re-election of the President. Glenn Saddam hired me in that position in June of 1972.
So you're also a member of the D.C.
D.C. Bar, right. I was admitted on motion here in D.C. Didn't require taking an exam. It was merely coming up with a fee of about, I think, $200. For the privilege of defending my own speeding tickets, whatever might come up.
Did you have a secretary for this period of time that you were here, or did you just share?
It was a confusing situation in that Darlene Moles, the girl in the office next door, did most of her own work, and I guess my secretary was primarily Ann Dawson. But of course, Ann answered the phone for Darlene as well.
Okay, so you and Darlene more or less shared.
Shared Ann, right? And then after the office was reorganized, shall we say, Jane Thomas, who was John Dean's old secretary, also worked for the both of us.
Could you give me a rough idea of the amount of documentation that a researcher might find relating to your activities?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start off by saying 95% of everything I wrote was for someone else's signature, most usually Fred Fielding's, occasionally Mr. Dean's, occasionally Mr. Garment's. And my written output was not that great, because I think over half my time was spent in regard to the clearance of nominations for presidential appointments. One of the responsibilities of the counsel's office was to clear nominations which required Senate confirmation. We have a procedure for this. We would supervise the FBI background check that is required of all presidential nominees before they're, the nomination actually is proposed. Nominee is proposed by Jerry Jones and the personnel office, sent to us. And we supervise the FBI inquiry through Jane Dannenhauer. And we also send out a form under Mr. first of all under Mr. Dean's signature and then later under Mr. Fielding's. Apparently Mr. Garment didn't get into it and just let Mr. Fielding keep the responsibility. The form asked some, 21 questions, and the forms would be returned and generally turned over to me. And I would look at them. The major concentration was on the individual's financial holdings, to be certain that his investments would not conflict with his proposed duties. And often this would require a phone call to the nominee and discussion with him, and sometimes a blind trust would be set up where we might fear a conflict, where we had great problems. We'd ask the gentleman if he would divest of his stock prior to formally accepting the job. In the records, there's a quick form of a memo from Fielding to Jones, which says that so and so is, based upon information he's provided us, is cleared from a conflict of interest standpoint for the proposed position, whatever it might be. For each of these appointments, it would be necessary to research the particular statutes governing the office and seeing if there were any specific qualifications involved that we'd have to look into in regard to the individual proposed. These range for example, someone appointed to the FCC could not hold interests in communications companies. In certain areas, there were special qualifications. Board of directors of various independent government corporations would require people with various backgrounds. Another prime example is a commission or an agency which would require no more than X amount of individuals from one political background. So all these questions would come up. Occasionally, I would get into the FBI aspect of this too, in that Mr. Fielding or Mr. Dean would ask me to review someone's background folder and determine if there was anything in there which would go against the individuals being further considered for the post. Jane Dannenhauer originally would look at it, and if there are any questions in her mind, would send a folder up to Fielding, and then he would sometimes pass it on to me, I guess depending on in part on what the nomination was and in part on his own time schedule. Other things we basically got into, we'd review proposed executive orders from a legal and from a policy standpoint, but they generally had been pretty thoroughly gone over in advance. When an executive order is proposed, it generally is sent first to OMB, and OMB sends it to the Office of Legal Counsel over to the Department of Justice, and then finally gets to us. So it would only be on a rare occasion when I catch a mistake and call that to Mr. Fielding's attention. And he would review what my suggestions were, sometimes pass them along, sometimes not regarded as significant, and go ahead with it. I have also dealt quite extensively with pardon matters. The counsel to the president has responsibility of reviewing pardon recommendations sent over by the U.S. by the Department of Justice, the pardon attorney over there, Mr. Traylor. And the way the system works is Traylor initially would get the paperwork and make a recommendation to the Attorney General as to whether the petition should be granted or denied. He'd send the Attorney General would then forward recommendations under his signature formally to the President, but in reality to the counsel's office, and we'd review them. And I think in about 99% of the instances concur in his recommendations. If there in our mind was a problem, we'd ask for the complete file. I can recall one instance where Darlene Moles sent for a file some time back, and I think that's about the only clear recollection I have of overruling one of their decisions. I only got into the pardon aspect of things after Darlene left, which I guess is what, about a month ago or so. Yeah, so I didn't get too deeply into the pardon aspect of things. Traditionally, the way the system has worked is pardons would be granted in July and December. We'd hold all the favorable recommendations to then, and the president would issue a master list pardoning a certain amount of individuals each year. I don't think we did one this July. I guess we've got some favorable recommendations waiting. I don't know exactly when we'll go through with it.
Out of curiosity, I know nothing about this. How many of these might come up in the course of a year's time?
Well, there are statistics on that. I don't have them at my fingertips now, but I would say that we'd get roughly 1,000 denials and 100 to 200 recommendations that clemency be granted. Let me make something clear. Most of the matters involved are pardons for a crime that was committed sometime hence and the sentence had been served. An individual would just want a pardon so that, this is as a prophylactic measure, he would feel better about it. But it would also relieve him of some liabilities. It would give him the right to vote. It would allow him in many jurisdictions to own a liquor store or a bar, something of that sort. A few of the pardons involved commutation of sentences. These were very rarely granted and are really only granted if someone is suffering from terminal illness. In looking at past records, I would say that only 3 or 4 commutations were granted each year, and the remainder would all be granting of pardons to forgive crimes where sentence had been served or fine imposed. One of the things I got into fairly substantially was CAB decisions. The president is empowered by statute to approve or disapprove Civil Aeronautics Board decisions affecting foreign air transportation, international air carriage. And as you can see from my background, I had worked at the Civil Aeronautics Board for a year and a half and were given all of those decisions to review. It was my understanding that after the election 1972, the White House would be reorganized and John Dean given primary responsibility for overviewing regulatory commission matters. I think Mr. Flanagan did that previously. So I think that was one thing that was contemplated. What happened with, because of the Watergate and matters of that sort, he didn't get into at least the CAB aspect of things too quickly, and Mr. Flanagan's office continued to write most of the memos. I think that was a little bit of a political problem in that Mr. Flanagan wanted to keep responsibility for the regulatory agencies, but I don't know who made the decision. I presume it was Haldeman or Ehrlichman wanted Dean to have it.
But you did get involved in the CAB.
I did get involved in the CAB aspects. I really only, however, dealt with one important case, and that was a merger between Eastern Airlines and Carib Air, a small carrier in the Caribbean area. It was an interesting case, and my recommendation, actually, I wanted to modify what the minority of the Civil Aeronautics Board had proposed to do. Just to give you some idea of what happened, the merger had been hanging fire for a few years, and the Eastern had been providing millions of dollars in subsidies to keep Carib Air going under CAB sanction. The board voted 3-2 to disprove the merger. It came on over here for the president's consideration, and we reversed the board in the end and voted to allow Eastern to merge with Carib Air under conditions suggested by the board's minority. But strike that, I think the vote was 4-3 at that time. There were 7 board members and now there are 5. I'm not sure, but that in any way it was fairly unusual and fairly significant. There was a lot of interest in it. And initially Dean took some interest and then got more deeply involved in the Watergate matters, and I think we essentially deferred to Flanagan in the end, and Flanagan's memo went to the president recommending that the board be overturned and the merger be accepted as on terms as specified by the board minority. My own personal recommendation on the matter was to impose certain additional conditions which would have further protected Pan American Airlines. But I, in part, it was to really be certain on it, the matter would have required a lot more study than we were able to give it. It was a very difficult decision to make. There was a lot to be said for each of the viewpoints. But that was essentially the only big CAB matter I got involved in on a fairly routine basis. I reviewed many non-controversial foreign air carrier decisions and I think concurred in almost every instance. After Darlene Moles departed from here, I inherited a lot of her prior duties, specifically matters affecting use of the presidential seal. The council's office, under an executive order, has responsibility for making determinations when private citizens or corporations should be allowed to use the presidential seal. There's a section of the order that says that the counsel to the president will grant authority to use the seal if the circumstances of the use are exceptional from an historic, educational, or cultural standpoint. And we'd get about 5 or 6 requests for the seal a week and grant a few of them.
Is that right?
You know, often private collectors would write and ask if they could have a copy of the seal, and we'd have to turn them down.
What sort of uses would you approve?
Well, for example, use of the seal in an educational film about the presidency that someone might be making to distribute to primary or secondary schools. While the regulations themselves are pretty clear cut, and for example allows without our approval use of the seal as an architectural embellishment on monuments to former presidents or in bona fide news films, people wouldn't realize this and would still write anyway, and we'd write back and indicate that our permission for that wouldn't be needed. Again, most of these letters went out under Mr. Fielding's signature. And then particularly after Darlene left, I answered a lot of mail on a number of subjects under Fielding's signature. Whenever someone sent a letter to the White House that either the correspondence section had trouble answering or seemed to be of a specifically legal nature, it was sent on over here. Occasionally, of course, we'd refer inquiries out to various departments and agencies, but sometimes answer them ourselves. Another significant thing I got involved in briefly was the Kennedy Center. Apparently, Mr. Haldeman was a member of the board of directors of the Kennedy Center, and there was a controversy as to whether the American Film Institute should be allowed to establish a film theater at the center, and the exact terms of the contract. I was asked to review that and reported to Terry O'Donnell, wrote a memo and made a list of suggestions as to how the contract should be revised. Apparently there was some minor political controversy in regard to this center. At least certain people over there felt that some members of the board and the management of the center were anti-administration, and they were trying to ride herd on what was being done. And then finally, another project I got somewhat involved in was the establishment of a White House library here in the EOB. The Office of Emergency Preparedness, of course, went out of existence, I believe, June 30th, and they had a library facility in this building and also had one across the street in the OEP itself, the building across the street being a law library. And we are somewhat down the road. I don't think too much has been done recently, but we're going to combine both the law library and the OEP library here into one unit in this building. It will involve discarding a lot of material that is only germane to OEP. It might not even have been germane to OEP. We found stuff like reports on the armament industry during World War I sitting up there. Stuff that just had been lying around that had moved from agencies that had been established during World War II and before, and eventually got to OEP, and it's still sitting up there. They had a very extensive law library across the street, which never really was used, in kind of, I guess, what can only be described as mismanagement. They were supplying, were subscribing to a lot of legal court reporters. What else? Well, I don't know what.
Well, I've heard stories.
Yeah, you've probably heard stories. What I'm trying to say is there's a woman over there named Nan Devers who has been running that library for years and years. And I've had occasion to visit, and it's just phenomenal. I understand that they've stored everything that they have gotten for the last 4 years in a big warehouse in Chicago because it wouldn't fit. And it's, you know, $22,000 worth of unopened books have just piled up.
I had heard about that.
Yeah, that's, and if you ever visit over there, it's just...
I've talked with her a couple of times.
Stacks of paper. She's a very dedicated woman and means well, and has tried to do a good job, but has kind of been neglected and is off by herself.
I had one of the people over there tell me that she knows the material.
Yeah, she knows the material very well, and if her services could be put to use and a good administrator could be brought in, something could be made of that. The facilities are there, and the makings of a very good library. And if the project comes off, I think it will be good for this administration and succeeding administrations to have a nice White House library, but we shall see. And I think that's essentially it in an overview.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about some of these things. Roughly 50% of your time then was spent on the clearance of these presidential nominations.
Possibly more.
Good ballpark.
Yeah, I would think so.
Would there be anything in those folders on these people that would have any reference to your name, maybe your initials somewhere indicating approval or an indication that you had reviewed this? I'm thinking of this in terms of, let's say, if by chance some of these nominations become of historical interest, and someone want to trace the process that went through and who actually considered it and what were their opinions on it, if your initials on there or someone else's or yours isn't, that would give them some points.
Well, as I described, we cleared them with a standard memo from Mr. Fielding. My initials wouldn't be on that, but separate files are maintained in a safe on alphabetically on each individual person, and relevant documentation is kept in the file, at least the personal data statement that was filed by the individual in response to our questions, and occasionally a memo by me to Fielding or someone else setting forth a problem. My own personal notes would, I think, probably have been kept in there. I guess the files will eventually go to the library and be kept in a secure area. The FBI reports themselves are property of the FBI, and I guess will be returned to that agency. They're temporarily stored with Jane Dannenhauer's operation now, and access is very limited. I'd only be asked to look at one if there was a specific problem that I was assigned. As a matter of fact, Jane would not send up the file unless she noted something in it that might be detrimental to going forward with the nomination.
You mentioned that you followed up when Darlene left, and evidently you probably did some of this before she left, responding to general correspondence
mm-hmm.
that might have come
mm-hmm.
from...
Yeah, Fred generally would assign stuff out to Darlene, myself, or now Dudley Chapman, who's on the staff. Mr. Garment, who I guess came over here in early May to become acting counsel to the president, has deferred to Fred Fielding almost entirely in regard to the more routine functions of the office. As a matter of fact, I think Mr. Garment's secretary, Eleanor Connor, would get his mail and send anything that was not Watergate related or just did not seem of major import to Fred, and Fred would reassign it to Darlene and myself, and later Dudley and myself. A number of things he'd handle on his own, I presume.
This material that Fred might assign to you or Darlene, whatever paperwork you generated on it, would that be retained in the files, and would your name or initial be somewhere on it?
No, it would invariably just, I would send it over to Fred with a buck slip with an answer in his name. I guess my name wouldn't be retained on it.
Sometimes on the carbon, the initial of the person that drafted something
mm-hmm.
appear first.
Yeah, we didn't use that procedure, and I when you, now that you mention it, we should have, but we did not.
Did you do any traveling?
I did none. Mm-hmm. None at all. I sat in on a couple of meetings at Fred's suggestion or John Dean's suggestion. Federal Property Council is one that comes to mind. A meeting over in the East Wing with Cora Logos about the Farkas nomination to be ambassador to Luxembourg. She was a major campaign contributor. I don't know if you recall, but there was some controversy about. Now, a question has come up a number of times whether campaign contributors should be, quote, rewarded, unquote, with diplomatic posts. And I got into that somewhat. And an occasional meeting like that, I would just be, when they were busy, I would be sent over to represent the office in some matter.
I was going to ask that because I have talked with other people in other offices, well, the Congressional Relations Office, the Personnel Office, Harry Dent's office
mm-hmm.
also. At varying times, representatives from these offices would get together to review people who were being considered for nomination.
Mm-hmm.
I think counsel's office was always present.
We were always in on it. And I think counsel's office has always been a backup when controversy has come up. I think that was one of Dean's major roles, and that's how he was not inaccurate when he made that statement that in the Watergate hearings that he always got involved in controversies and scandals. He would be assigned to go in there and try to salvage the situation somehow. And the nominations, of course, we were directly responsible for the clearances from both a political standpoint, security standpoint, and in the conflict of interest standpoint, so that was not unusual.
Would it be fair to say then that the counsel's office probably considered more things when a person was being considered for a position than any of the other offices in the White House that had some interest in that nomination?
Not really, in that the personnel office would bring the candidate forward. I don't think that the counsel's office could come up with a candidate for anything and try to back him, but if a nomination were sent over and there were problems with it, we of course would get into it. But you know, the personnel office would initially come up with the nomination, often on a recommendation from the Hill, or a department nomination on the recommendation of the secretary. And I know there were, you know, there were problems in that regard, and that Haldeman or Ehrlichman might want someone, and a secretary might want someone else for an assistant secretaryship. But we never got in on that type of a dispute. We would just deal with the nomination after it had been formally proposed. Now, often they'd send two people to be cleared for the same post. I guess there might have been an urgency of time, and we'd have to look at both of them from the conflicts and FBI standpoint. And unless there was a problem with either of them, we really wouldn't have any input into who got the job in the end.
As long as they satisfied the legal requirements.
The legal requirements in the statute, right, and the conflict of interest was not a problem.
Okay. Beyond that, you had no input, really.
I definitely didn't, and maybe Dean did in regard to certain legal positions. I just don't know. I've heard rumors that, you know, one of his functions was to look at the legal slots in government, and particularly in the Justice Department, and he could occasionally suggest his own candidates. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration of his powers, I just don't know, but I can think of a couple of instances where, you know, through the grapevine, I've heard that he caused people to lose their chance of getting a job. I just don't know.
I can see where it doesn't sound all that illogical for someone who had been over at Justice and mm-hmm, is counsel mm-hmm. to the President mm-hmm. to have some opinions on the matter.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've mentioned that several of these meetings that you've attended, various areas of the White House. Did you set in on any regular meetings that might have come up anywhere in the complex?
No, I really didn't. It was a rare occasion that I would attend a meeting.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the operation of the Office of Counsel, could you very briefly give me the hierarchy under John Dean and then perhaps under Leonard Garment as you see it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, first of all, it's a very small operation. When I came here, there was Dean Fielding as deputy counsel to the president, Dave Wilson, myself, and Darlene. And I guess that was almost the order of stature, because Darlene was not a full-fledged attorney yet. She was studying, still in law school, or had just graduated law school, and was studying for a bar. I replaced a gentleman named Pete Kinsey, who went to the Atomic Energy Commission, I guess was here about a year. And he had responsibility for the pardon matters and the nomination clearances, and did some tax work, I think. I didn't really get into tax work. Well, David Wilson did a bunch of other things. It was structured somewhat. I can't recall. I once saw a chart which said what David did, what Pete did, and what Darlene did, but I can't recall exactly how it was broken down.
We hope to find that chart somewhere in the files.
Yeah, I think you probably will. And I guess I was contemplated to replace Peter, and David was leaving too, and I guess somebody else would eventually come on board to replace David. Now that Mr. Garment's here, the structure and what I regard as the counsel's office is essentially the same, in that Fred is still deputy, and Dudley Chapman has come aboard since and came here before Darlene left, but just moved down from another area. He's got a title of associate counsel to the president. He's been a justice and is an experienced attorney. Brad Peterson came along with Mr. Garment. He's not an attorney. He, I think, still reports to Mr. Garment on Indian matters, cultural matters, some of the projects Mr. Garment was in charge of before he came down here. The Special Watergate Group I regard as separate from this office. Now, maybe on paper they are part of this office, but you've got, let's see, well, Professor Wright is a consultant, and Andrews and Bizzard are on loan from defense, and they really just deal with Mr. Garmert on the Watergate and related matters of that sort. I think it's eventually contemplated that once this thing is over with, they'll all depart and not stay on the staff.
The responsibilities then that the various members of the Office of Counsel have had, let's say from Feeling on down, whether under Dean or under Garmert, are pretty much the same then, aren't they?
I think they are. There seems to be a lot less to do and less of a... Well, maybe it's just that this whole thing has you know, upset the workflow here and everything else, but there's less important substantive stuff now than there was when I first came here. There's no question about that. You know, we still get the nominations are still progressing. There are less of them now only because most of the spots have been filled. And we still get, you know, executive orders, proclamations to review, and matters are still staffed to us, but it just seems that there's less important stuff to do.
Well, like you say, it may be a temporary phenomenon.
It might be. It might well be. I'm sure that anything that was staffed to Dean is now staffed to Garmert. The only thing I can think that might be different is Garmert might not have overview of the regulatory agencies as was contemplated when Dean first came here.
Are there any newspaper, magazine articles, or journal articles that deal with any aspects of the counsel's office that you had any input in or knowledge of? On occasion, someone will cite a journal article, perhaps one, say National Journal, and they'll say it's a good article or it's a bad article. If we have that much information to go on, when we may Xerox copy of that. I should say photocopy that rather than Xerox.
Mm-hmm.
We can put that in the folder and indicate so-and-so says this is a good article or so-and-so says it's a bad article. This provides some guidance to us as well as researchers in the future who might stumble across the article and say, well, is this a reliable article or not? We can say, well, Joe Adams said in this particular article is superficial or it's a good article or something like that.
Nothing I can really recall on in regard to what we're supposed to be doing as opposed to what might have happened over the last year. let's put it that way.
Okay.
My name came up once, I'm happy to say. I guess if you were interviewing someone 8 or 9 months ago, they'd be happy to see their name in print. Now it's become a liability, but it was only in reference to a trade journal, I can recall, talking about the airline industry, discussing the fact that I was working on airline matters here and had worked on the Eastern Carabair case.
What journal was that?
I can't even recall. It was a trade weekly, I think. Very limited circulation. Specialty journal, as you often find in Washington dealing with the particular industry.
Your contacts within the White House complex, I gather, were on a when necessary basis rather than a continuing basis.
Mm-hmm.
Would there be any office or any shop within the White House complex that you might have had regular dealings with?
Well, we had extensive contact, of course, with the personnel people. Well, Julie Robbins was the person in charge of the clearance process. She would get the proposed nominations from, I guess, Jerry Jones, and then staff it out to the RNC to hear, and whenever there was something that needed to be rushed, for example, she would call up. And then on substantive matters, I'd talk to Fred Karam or Lynn Arroyo over there, but they often dealt with Fred. Fred has occasionally been terribly backlogged with work, so in an attempt to get around the bottleneck, they'd sometimes call me and I'd go in and talk to Fred about a specific problem.
Congressional Relations Office?
Very infrequently. Occasionally we get congressional letters referred over here, but other than that Farkas nomination, I really haven't even had any meetings with him. I've done some work on the library with Ann Morgan and a bunch of other people. We set up a committee to try and resolve the library issue, and I was the representative of the council's office to examine the legal research aspects of it.
Now, when you speak of the library issue, you're referring to the OEP library.
The OEP library and bringing it all over here. One time it was, there was a question as to whether there might in fact be an independent library, something that Nan Devers was lobbying for intensively. As smoothly as possible, we have tried to turn it into a single operation. I've had some contact with Dave Gunning on Flanagan's staff regard to the CAB.
Domestic Council people?
Only to the extent that Craig Gosden as staff secretary over there would send us over matters for comment. Occasionally bills, executive orders, proclamations. But whatever input that I had would go through Fred in a memo from Fred to Gosden.
OMB?
No, I can't really recall anything significant.
Moving outside the White House complex, or the executive office, I should say, department and agencies, were there any that you had?
Yeah, this office has traditionally worked very closely with the Office of Legal Counsel over the Department of Justice. And we would often send memos asking for legal research into an area or call up and ask their opinion on something before we went ahead and went through with it. I particularly talked to Leon Ullman over there, who has been in government a long time and I found to be a very good source to, and a very good sounding board.
How do you spell his last name?
Ullman, I believe.
But outside of that particular office, then probably did not have much contact with other departments and agencies.
No.
Except on a when necessary.
Exactly, basis. Exactly. I would occasionally talk to the general counsel of a particular department or agency in regard to a proposed appointment, trying as best possible not to reveal the identity of the nominee, but trying to resolve factual circumstances in regard to stock holdings or qualifications or whatever. It's surprisingly enough, I think 95% of the time they come back to me, "Oh, you mean Mr. So-and-so." So I think that's an indication that secrets are not well kept in government.
I think you mentioned in passing Republican National Committee. Anybody up there that you dealt with other than just on a routine basis?
No, I mentioned Republican National Committee in regard to the clearance procedure as something Jerry Jones would do with a nominee that had to go before the Senate. Of course, we would have to get a sign off from the senators from the nominee's home state, and I say we, I mean the White House, and that's they dealt with the RNC. We dealt with it very infrequently.
I take it then that you probably didn't have any contacts with Capitol Hill other than very rarely.
Exactly, yeah.
moving beyond the government itself. How about outside the government?
We would occasionally get phone calls from citizens who would have particular problems that they thought the White House would be able to help them out with. And often we'd get calls back from people to whom we had already responded in a letter. The great, great bulk of these calls were hopeless cases. We got some input from Eastern Airlines in regard to the merger case, and some input from the government of Jamaica, which wanted the merger to go through. How they found out that the dean's office was working on it, I don't know, but they sent some documentation and came and requested a meeting, and we met with them. That was the extent of that, really. I think that's about it.
And the files that you've generated and created will remain here within the files of the office?
Right. It's because of the fact that a lot of these things are ongoing and preceded me, presidential seal, the nominations, CAB. We'll have to keep working files on all of those things, and I think it'd probably be simpler just for me to combine my work product with whoever came before me and whoever will come after me.
Do you know who's going to be coming in?
I do not, and I've heard a rumor that the position will not be filled immediately.
Well, I think, Joe, that answers the questions that we try and cover in this. Now, before I turn on the tape recorder, I went through a bunch of them. I think you wrote them down.
Right.
And if I hit all of those that I mentioned, I'm in good shape.
Let me see here. No, I think we just about covered it all, Terry. Seems like a lot for 6 months, I'm surprised. thought this would be a much briefer interview.
We even encountered other situations like that where somebody would say, well, I just really didn't do any except very routine stuff, won't take very long. And in some cases, those are the ones that have gone on and on and on.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, we've got some very good information. In some instances, not so much in regards to what the individual might have done, but that person's perspective of the office operation or something has been very, very good and astute, and they've shed light on it that someone who might have been much more deeply involved in it wouldn't have been able to see. So, it's very beneficial.
One of my most interesting roles here was just being a spectator and watching Mr. Dean leave and Mr. Carmen come in.
We'll talk to you about that in 20 years from now.
Okay.